This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In the year 2025, if man is still alive, if a woman can survive, they may find.
Welcome, traveler from 2024. You just came from the hottest year humans ever lived. For 16 consecutive months, from June 2023 to September 24, the global mean temperature exceeded anything recorded before, and often by a wide margin, according to the World Meteorological Organization. You don't need to be a weatherman to know what is coming. You don't need AI. We have the science. This planet will get hotter and hotter. Ice is leaving the earth from the poles, tall mountains, and the sea. The rising darker ocean embraces more solar energy. An era of disasters arrives and stays until some thousands of years later a new order is established. Earth returns to its hothouse state that dominates time on this planet. Here in human microtime, another year begins. For the next storms, floods, and fires, only a few numbers matter. Greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The players are important, the amounts are critical, but a new devil appears, the rate of change. From biological systems to ocean currents, new science finds again and again, the rate of change is as important as the amount. 2024 is on track to be the warmest year on record, with global temperatures reaching 1.54 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, according to the WMO. But that organization calls this warming temporary, likely due to the previous El Niño, we will see. 2024 is thought to be 0.1 degrees C hotter than the previous hottest year, 2023. If that is confirmed, warming at 0.1 degrees C per year would heat Earth by 2.5 degrees C over pre-industrial by 2035. At that rate, we might reach civilization-ending heat of 3 degrees C by 2040, meaning collapse, global collapse, in just 15 years. Humans must attack the rate of warming for organized society to survive. Antarctic sea ice is at its second lowest on record. 2023 was the lowest. That means the reflective solar shield of ice around the poles is becoming substantially smaller. The darker ocean is absorbing the extra energy. You know from the news, if not from your own life, that extreme weather events are getting worse. The hurricanes, the typhoons, the wildfires, freak flash floods, and creeping drought are too hard to miss. Oceans are record hot, especially in the North Atlantic. We covered a lot of this on this program. Check out our free archive at ecoshock.org to hear what the scientists say. Let's get straight to the drivers, the greenhouse gases. The best known is carbon dioxide. Around two-thirds of warming comes from CO2, measured as parts per million in the atmosphere. The carbon dioxide level at the Mauna Loa Observatory is around 425 parts per million as of December 2024. CO2 concentrations have increased 11.4% in just 20 years, according to the World Meteorological Organization. Let's pay attention to that critical growth rate. According to NOAA, CO2 levels in November 2023 were 420 parts per million and 423 parts per million in November 2024. The difference comes to 3.39 parts per million higher in 1 year. Growth rate in 1975 was 1.23 parts per million, almost a third less. In the year 2000, CO2 increase was still only 1.25. parts per million, but that was a lower year when the increase was bouncing between 1.5 parts per million and 2.3 parts per million until 2010. Growth rate was 2.79 in 2023, according to NOAA. Now it is 3.3.
Mighty methane.
The second major warming gas, though, that we have to talk about is methane. It's a single carbon atom surrounded by four atoms of hydrogen. In 2024, methane levels in the atmosphere are rising at a faster rate than any other major greenhouse gas. According to NOAA, in August 2023, methane averaged 1,917 parts per billion in the atmosphere. By 2024, that was 1,926 parts per billion, an increase of 9 parts per billion in 1 year. And that covers a lot of the global atmosphere. The methane growth rate per year varies widely over time. For example, it was 14 parts per billion in 1991, but that was because of a great cloud of methane released in the huge Pinatubo volcanic eruption in the Philippines that year. Then methane levels decreased up to about 7 parts per billion by 1993. And from the year 2000 to 2006, methane growth was kind of muted and some experts stopped worrying about it. Then around 2007, this highly potent greenhouse gas began climbing again, the rate increasing from 5 to 7 parts per billion per year. By 2014, methane increase hit double digits of 10 to 12, and then a 15 parts per billion in 2020, 17 in 2021, and slumping slightly in 2023. Remember, we're not talking about the amount of methane in the atmosphere directly, but the rate, the key rate of the increase. Let's go to the third big one. It's nitrous oxide, and that is where too much of climate reporting stops. So they talk about carbon dioxide, maybe methane, but there are far more greenhouse gases rising into the air from human activities. We can't lose sight of this in a focus on carbon dioxide. Although estimates differ slightly, nitrogen oxide is responsible for about 10% of net global warming since the Industrial Revolution. It's also the top ozone-depleting substance still being released into the atmosphere, and that's important. 65% of nitrogen oxide emissions come from human activities. Nitrous oxide has a global warming potential of around 280 times greater than CO2, and once it's up there, NO2 stays in the atmosphere for over 100 years. Nitrous oxide emissions have accelerated greatly in the last 40 years. From 1980 to 2020, emissions increased by 40%. We didn't see it coming. This dramatic increase in nitrous oxide in the atmosphere is greater than all the climate models predicted. NOAA says the annual increase measured for nitrous oxide during 2020, 21, and 22 are among the fastest recorded since measurements began, end quote. Nitrous oxide wafts into the atmosphere from the use of fertilizers made from natural gas, of course. Nitrous oxide is also known as a byproduct of burning all fossil fuels. Oil, gas, and coal, whenever you burn them, nitrous oxide is one of the things that comes out. Poor wastewater management adds more nitrous oxide to the air, too. But there are other rare but extremely potent human-made gases like hexafluorethane and sulfur hexafluoride, and they're rising at increasing rates. These super greenhouse gases come mainly from petrochemical processes and chemical manufacturing. They could be controlled by regulations and international agreements, but so far are not. According to climate.gov from the U.S., the annual greenhouse gas index is a measure that tracks the global warming influence of all human-emitted greenhouse gases, which was 51% higher in 2023 than it was in 1990. But the government figures and science reports simply leave out the single largest gas retaining heat on this planet, water vapor. We know that for every degree of warming, the atmosphere can hold 7% more water vapor, which is about 2 to 3 times more potent in warming than carbon dioxide. The annual greenhouse gas index does not include it, and that has been because water vapor is considered to come and go quickly, often within weeks, and actual amounts in the atmosphere can vary over time. Still, with a proven hotter atmosphere driven by human activity, we can now consider the increase in water vapor in the air as permanent. It should be added to our carbon dioxide equivalent to get the real atmosphere warming gas total, and it should be included in the rates of increase. We are not getting the full picture, despite increasing obvious climate impacts. Humans always give themselves a loophole, don't we? A special exception for us from the laws of physics and living things. So, what do all these numbers mean? The rate of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are increasing at alarming rates higher than official predictions. We are still lying to ourselves about how fast this is getting worse. Just as a new climate denial and backpedaling mechanism takes over in many countries and in corporate boardrooms, humans are abandoning some of their weakest attempts to protect ourselves and coming generations from a catastrophic climate shift. We have to fight that off at least. Slightly on the positive side, solar installations are increasing around the world, that's for sure, and especially in the developing world. Some economies may truly leapfrog past dependency on fossil fuels. Electric vehicles are starting to dominate new vehicle sales in some parts of the world. However, all the added renewable energy is soaking up some of the increase in energy demand only, as more of the world enters a digital industrial state. We are producing more fossil fuels than ever. That's the reality. Remember all the talk about coal being on the way out? Well, according to a new report published December 2024 from the International Energy Agency, coal burning has reached a new record peak and is expected to remain there for years. China alone burns 30% more coal than the rest of the world combined. This is very disturbing news. It's bleak and it's black. Worse, just as the world needs to slash energy demand with heat pumps and efficiency and reduced consumption, all that stuff, along comes a new technology that eats fossil fuels. Artificial intelligence is sweeping the world. I produce new images for each Radio EcoShock show with AI. According to brand new research, each of my attempts at an image uses as much energy as charging a cell phone. Every image. As you know, the biggest AI producers and servers are rushing to nail down major energy sources. Microsoft plans to reopen the fatally flawed Three Mile Island reactors to power their AI. These are the same designs that blew up in Japan. Not a good idea. A coal utility in Nebraska was going to close, but now that stays open for AI, including Google. Even if AI decides on using renewable sources, that sucks up the limited market for renewables and other human needs like heating and cooling and lights. Is the arrival of energy-sucking AI at the very time of critical need for reductions just bad luck in human affairs? Or is it a natural outcropping of a fossil fuel society with no regard for other living things and the future? Either way, the verdict is the critical next 10 years to slash emissions before irreversible tipping points looks doomed at the outset. ''2024 may be the hottest year you ever lived and the coolest year you will ever experience. With possible exceptions, every year from here on out may be the hottest and coolest for all of us and all life. Until something in human production breaks, collapses, or a miracle revolution comes. There were very dark times in the last century, and they ended. Human existence has been temporary ever since, as nuclear mutual annihilation hovers over us. But wars and bombs are still under human control. We can start them, and we can end them. Climate change, we can only start. Once the great warming starts, nature takes over with giant feedback loops like thawing permafrost and vanishing glaciers. Warming becomes its own thousand-year Reich, with humans helpless to stop it. Of course, we have illusions of saving ourselves with machines. We investigate that next.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
We turn to machines, begging on our knees, artificial savior. When will you save us? Oh, Deus Ex Machina.
The great hope is called direct air capture. International agencies already count DAC, as it's called, among solutions after overshooting the 1.5 degree safety mark. Two carbon capture plants are starting operations in Iceland, but how real is it? If anybody knows, it is Howard J. Herzog. He is a senior research engineer in the MIT Energy Initiative. Herzog is an expert in the field with many papers published about DAC. Now with three other senior and principal researchers, scientists at MIT, Herzog published a startling conclusion in a commentary titled, Getting Real About Capturing Carbon from the Air. From the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Howard Herzog, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Right. So if I want to build something or go anywhere or do much of anything, I just need the right machine. Machines seem to solve everything. Can we call direct air capture a machine? How does it work?
Well, it is a machine or a couple of machines. I call it more of a process that where you air comes in to your facility and then leaves with the CO2 taking out of it. And it's basically done in two steps. The first step is something that absorbs the CO2 from the air onto some sort of sorbent, which is some sort of chemical. It grabs the CO2 out of the air. And then in the second step, you release that CO2 and capture it, so you have highly concentrated CO2 that you can then, in general, what you would do is put it in deep geologic formations. Some people are also trying to use it in different ways, but the uses for that CO2 are fairly small, and the capacity to put it underground is quite large.
So in whatever planning we allegedly have, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the COP mechanism, the governments, the private corporations, are they counting on direct air capture of carbon dioxide in our future plans?
So groups like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change summarize the literature and write these assessment reports. And they feed into the climate negotiations, and they are looked at by policymakers. So they look at what's in the literature. And you have a lot of groups around the world. I don't know the exact number, maybe around 20 major ones that do these energy economic evaluations, look at our emissions and our economics running out to the end of the century, and they look at different scenarios. And in the past 5 years or so, what we call negative emissions, or taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, it has creeped into these models and therefore is being reported by the IPCC. In fact, to meet the targets, whether it's 1.5 degrees C or 2 degrees C stabilization, because we are not reducing our emissions great enough, it looks like we're going to overshoot it. So most of these scenarios that we look at overshoot our target and need to come down by taking CO2 out of the air. The way to do that, there's a whole bunch of ways, some biological, some chemical, to do that. But recently, what's called direct air capture has sort of become a hot topic. And one reason is things that take CO2 out of the air, like planting trees. Well, that's nice, but what happens 10 or 20 years down the road if the forest burns down or there's a pestilence and the trees die? It's not that permanent. What you see from direct air capture is what people look at as a really high-quality carbon removal credit. You can measure it. You can actually see the CO2 you take out of the air. It's immediate, and storing it in geological formations is essentially a permanent solution of keeping it out of the atmosphere.
How far has the industry progressed?
You can go back in the literature and see some of the first references to direct air capture in sort of the way it's being implemented today, going back to around the year 2000 or so. So it's been around 25 years. But it's only been in the past, what I would say, less than 10 years, that it's really being looked at seriously with significant investment going into the field. And what we see today are several pilot plants, but on the scope of things, these pilot plants are small. So we're putting out, the world's putting out, I forget the exact number, 40, 50 billion tons of CO2 or CO2 equivalent a year of greenhouse gases. And to really operate on that scale, you need to be operating at the billion ton a year level. Right now, the biggest direct air capture plant in operation is 4,000 tons a year, and that's up in Iceland by a company called Climeworks. Oxy, the oil company down in Texas, is constructing a plant that will become the world's biggest if it goes online. It's supposed to go online mid-next year. That would be 250,000 tons a year. So we see some examples of this out there, but they're at a very, very small level compared to what we have to do to really scale up the technology to have an impact on climate change.
Yes, I looked into the DAC plant, the Mammoth plant it's called in Iceland, operated by Climeworks. They just opened part of the new facility in May 2024. The nameplate capacity for carbon capture is 36,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide a year. Just back of envelope calculations on my part finds we would need about 1 million of those to even stay with current emissions. Talk to us about the problems of scale when actually trying to build our way out of carbon overshoot.
Let me first say there are other methods, and there's certain pathways that I think are more promising than direct air capture for doing it. I think all the methods can make some sort of contribution doing it, but one of the biggest barriers for direct air capture itself is the amount of energy it needs to take the CO2 out of the air. It's fairly energy intensive. If it was next to a power plant, a coal-fired power plant, and that coal-fired power plant was feeding the electricity into the direct air capture plant, for every molecule of CO2 taken out of the air by the direct air capture plant, the coal plant will put up 1.2 molecules of CO2, which, of course, does us no good. So you really need low-carbon energy to run these things. Unfortunately, we don't have enough low-carbon energy today to do everything that we want. We still have a lot of oil and gas in our electricity production system. We want to increase our low-carbon energy to fuel our electric vehicles. We need it to power our heat pumps. People talk about green hydrogen. You need electricity for that, or carbon-free electricity for that. So there's a lot of uses for this. So that's one barrier to scaling it up. And the other barrier, which, you know, was a main thrust of the article we wrote, was the cost of doing this.
Yes, one DAC design requires a giant concrete and steel structure 3 stories high, 3 miles long. You wonder if these machines can even overcome the carbon used in their construction and operation and maintenance.
Well, at this point, that is, you know, the life cycle is an issue on that. You know, if for, say, 30 or 40 years in the future and we've really decarbonized our energy system, then those materials will be also become decarbonized. But today, finding carbon-free energy to run the plant and also to make the materials needed by the plant is the problem. And all of this traces back. The real challenge is the low concentration of carbon dioxide in the air. So even though from climate reasons we have too much carbon dioxide in the air from a chemical process, it's very, very small. It's about, 420 ppm today, or 0.042%. And that makes it difficult, not only difficult to remove, but you need to process a lot of air just to grab 1 ton. So to get thousands of tons or millions of tons and then up to billions of tons, that's a lot of air to process, and that takes big machines and lots of energy.
And you found studies that may be used in government planning with unrealistic projections for both the cost per ton and the total CO2 capture that could be expected from DAC. Do you want to tell us about this disconnect, particularly the cost per ton angle?
Yes. So, as we say, Climeworks, which has a plant operating in Iceland and a second plant that you mentioned, the Mammoth plant, coming online, actually you can go to their website, and as an individual, you can buy carbon credits from them. The cost of those carbon credits, they don't talk about in dollars per ton, but it's an easy conversion to make, is $1,500 per ton of CO2, which is very large. A lot of high-tech companies and, say, airline companies are trying to buy credits. And, you know, and even though a lot of these numbers aren't public, it seems like the numbers they're paying are the high $100 per ton, approaching $1,000 per ton. This is very expensive. When you look at the price in the European emissions trading system, their numbers are about $100 a ton to keep CO2 out of the atmosphere. So when you're talking on the order of $1,000 a ton, it's very expensive, and, you know, is that really sustainable to pay it? So you got to get the numbers down. And so people, of course, you know, these companies are pitching to industry, and they say, we can get the cost down. And they absolutely can get the cost down. But the question is, how far can they get the cost down? And a lot of them are saying we get down to even $100 a ton, and the U.S. DOE has a target of $100 a ton for carbon removal from all the different various methods, and that number is sort of stuck, you know, so you see a lot in the range of $100 to $300. But from our engineering analysis, based on how much air you have to capture, how much energy you need to use, and all of this, we just find that unrealistic. How far they can get down, anybody's guess. I made a guess in an article I wrote a couple years ago saying maybe by 2030 we can get to $600 to $1,000 range. People say I'm way too conservative. They're more bullish than that. But I say let's wait and see. I haven't seen any evidence to make me revise my thing. And I'll tell you how some of these things work. So people say, okay, there's something called learning by doing, and it's fairly well established that as a technology matures and you learn by doing, the price will come down. So you have a price today, and you keep doing it, and price comes down. The problem is we're so early in direct air capture that we don't know what the real price is today. And, in fact, a lot of times projects that are in the early stage, prices increase. So one problem with direct air capture, you got to harden it to the weather. Well, a lot of times in the laboratory you're doing cost estimates, you don't really, you sort of ignore that. But then when you go out in the field, okay, now I got to add this cost. So lots of costs get added. So we don't know what the cost is today. And secondly, we don't know how fast that cost will come down. And what people do on learning curve, they assume, all right, I'm going to sell so much quantity and the price will come down so much percent. But I would claim that that's a fairly empirical thing. We've seen curves from, say, solar energy and the like, but that doesn't mean that same curve is going to apply here. So what they'll do, and I've seen several papers on this, they'll say, okay, here's the price today. It's going to come down, and the price will end up here. Well, you know, theoretically, all right, but in reality, I don't believe it. And the other thing is, they don't take the constraints into the model. There's minimum energy you're going to need. There's minimum amount of steel and concrete you're going to need. And we don't know all those prices. So we don't, you know, I get into debates with people. What's the price of carbon-free electricity in 2050? No one really knows. And people say, oh, look at the solar and wind so cheap today, you can get it for this and this. But yet, while we have cheap solar and wind, electricity prices in aggregate go up because solar and wind are intermittent, and the electricity we want to use for most of our things, including the direct air capture plants, have to be 24/7.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog.
ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest from MIT, energy specialist Howard Herzog. Data centers are becoming major power consumers, threatening to gobble up any gains from efficiency or electrification of transport. What have you heard about big tech investments or plans for direct air capture to overcome the big climate risk of, say, the AI revolution?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything directly with data centers. I know that some data centers are trying to revive nuclear power plants. But my background for most of my work here the past 35 years has been on carbon capture and storage from point sources. So that actually is a pretty good fit with data centers, that you can have, say, a gas power plant, put carbon capture on the exhaust, a lot easier to capture that carbon when the concentration of the CO2 is about, over 100 times more than in the air, and then we can put it in the ground, and you have 24/7 carbon-free electricity from a natural gas plant with carbon capture and storage.
And one of the competitors for DAC, and a lot of science and government subsidies went into this, is bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, which is called BECCS. And I looked at the Drax wood-burning power station in the UK, for example, and found a report that its real carbon cost might be higher than burning UK coal. You said that you had kind of a preferred solution going here. Would you like to tell us about that?
I'm a big fan of BECCS. As I say, I haven't looked at the Drax. Well, the Drax plant does not have carbon capture and storage on it at this point. What they did was convert from coal to biomass or wood. And they're shipping a lot of that wood from the southeast of the United States. But basically, if you burn biomass in a power plant and capture the CO2, put it in the ground, what you've essentially done is the trees take the CO2 out of the air. When we burn it, the CO2 is released, but we capture it, put it in the ground. So now you actually have a net from the air to the ground, or what we call negative emissions, with the BECCS plant. And if those negative emissions can be monetized, it could be a fairly cost-effective way. Numbers that we did a paper a number of years ago, and the number we put for large-scale BECCS is about $240 a ton of CO2. The key there is you have to have sustainable biomass coming in. So the ideal thing would be to have your biomass supply, say, a large forest, where you're harvesting biomass from that forest, but only at the rate that that forest is absorbing the CO2 from the air. And, you know, the question is how much forest space is there, or how much, or there could be also other agricultural products, how much is there? I'm not an expert at that, but my talking with people in the industry and doing some reading is the opportunities, I think, are much greater than a lot of people think and are very significant for doing that. So that's actually one negative emission technology that I think we're underutilizing. And these models I talked about earlier that looked at negative emissions, they actually started with BECCS. That was the one they first used, and only recently has sort of direct air capture become, should I say, the flavor of the month.
Well, yes, supposing we really go for DAC, and despite budget slashing and huge government debts, the big governments embark on an emergency plan to build machines that suck carbon out of the air. Would this cost billions or trillions?
Well, let's just do a quick calculation. If we're going to do 1 billion tons a year, and we need to take a cost. So if you took the $100 a ton, you're talking about $100 billion a year. If you take the $1,000 thing, we're talking about $1 trillion a year. And that's for 1 billion tons. Right now we have about a 40 billion ton problem worldwide. So
very expensive. So you've published about getting real about direct air capture. Have you had any pushback or replies of people criticizing or cheering you?
Some, but, you know, people that push back never really want to discuss the underlying technologies. I'm a chemical engineer. I have in the past designed plants, and that's what these are. They're a type of chemical plant. And there's fundamentals there. And before I wrote this article, I wrote an article a couple years ago, much more detailed on the engineering. No one has taken me up on the engineering. You know, they don't question that. They just say things like, well, our energy is only going to cost 1 or 2 cents a kilowatt hour, so that's going to be cheap. People are starting to say, well, we're not going to have these big machines. We're just going to have the sorbent sitting out in the air, and then we'll do it, and that will save money. And, you know, none of these things, from an engineering point, I feel, are realistic. There's a lot of momentum. I just saw, like 2 days ago, Heirloom, another direct air capture company, just got a lot of funding from, I can't remember all the companies, but a number of companies. So money's still going into this. People want it, you know. People don't want to miss the boat. But I just look at it as an engineer and say, you know, these are the fundamentals. And I've worked on carbon capture from point source for 35 years, which is a much easier problem. And we still, you know, there's facilities out there for it, but it's not a lot. This is difficult. It's, you know, so much cheaper to reduce our emissions at this point than to try to take it out of the air. I just think we're taking our eye off the ball, and we should just double down. I wrote a book on carbon dioxide removal. It's going to be published by MIT Press coming out in August. And my last sentence in the book is, the best way to remove carbon dioxide from the air is not put it into the air in the first place.
Well, we'll look forward to your book next August. I hope to get some sort of notice about that or see it coming up, and we'll take a look. From MIT, we have been talking with Howard J. Herzog, a senior research engineer in the MIT Energy Initiative. He and his colleagues published Getting Real About Capturing Carbon from the Air on September 20th, 2024. You can find links and more to follow up in my show blog. It's published every Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Howard, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
In reality, there is no global temperature or sea level rise. These are experienced where you are and differently everywhere. These days, climate shows up as local, fast, extreme events outside our best models. New work from Australia suggests we need to rethink climate and what seasons mean when extremes become the norm. Lead author of the new paper, Dr. Milton Spear, is a visiting fellow at the University of Technology, Sydney. His co-authors, Professor Lance Leslie, also at UTS. Their paper is Machine Learning Suggests Climate and Seasonal Definitions Should Change Under Global Warming. From Sydney, Milton Spear, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
According to a UN analysis that you cite, major natural disasters have doubled during the last 20 years compared to the 1980s and 90s. Climate-related disasters also more or less doubled. The new normal includes about 7,000 climate-driven disasters a year. That's about 20 disasters a day going on somewhere in the world. Milton, is climate science keeping up with that?
Our research suggests that in terms of climate normals, it's not really keeping up with that, because climate normals, as defined by the World Meteorological Organization, 30 years for climate change, they determined that 30 years was a climate normal. But, of course, some of these extreme events swinging from one extreme of, for example, rainfall from nothing to extreme monthly, daily, annual extremes, record events to nothing over time periods, over these seasonal and monthly, annual time periods. And this is happening on much shorter timescales than 30 years. So if you average out 30 years, you can lose a lot of statistical information on averages because a lot of these shorter periods cancel each other out in which the extremes occur.
Let's get into specifics in Australia, which you studied in depth, because I think similar problems pop up all over the world. It's a good case study. For example, this year you wrote about flash droughts. Now, what is a flash drought?
A flash drought is, it can occur when rainfall is just normally, can be just average rainfall, even above average rainfall. And then in a particular region of a continent or part of a continent, or even part of a state in the US or in Australia, which such as it was called the Upper Hunter region in eastern Australia, and it had average or above average rainfall in late 2022 and early 2023. But then suddenly in May there was no rainfall at all in this region, and then for the next few months the rainfall was very sparse. It was in the lowest 5 or 10% monthly readings for the next few months. Now, that's basically what a flash drought is. It occurs within a period of a few months after average or above average rainfall.
Well, some of Australia's droughts, of course, have lasted much longer than that. I remember it made a big impression on me in the early 2000s when the largest agricultural area there, the Murray-Darling Basin, the government had to decide, it looked like, between water for farming or people in the state capital of Adelaide. And Adelaide built a seawater desalinization plant, I think partly as a result of that. You did a study on precipitation changes in that watershed. What did you find, and is there a climate connection?
We've done several studies on that Murray-Darling Basin, I think you referred to. Yeah, the Murray-Darling Basin in southeastern Australia, which stretches over thousands and thousands of kilometres. There are two main river systems in that, but we've done a study on two rivers. Our last one was on large Darling River, which stretches from southeast, or the catchment stretches from southeast Queensland, where the dams are, and northeast New South Wales. Several streams feed the Darling River, which goes down and eventually reaches another river called the Murray River. And it flows into past Adelaide down there, and that's where the water just wasn't reaching there because a major factor was there just weren't the rainfall falling in the catchments. There were other issues as well, water extraction, building of on-farm dams to hold water, and the problems associated with that, evaporation, trying to hold water. But one of the major factors was the decrease in climate-wise was the decrease in cool season rainfall, which for us in southeast Australia is roughly April to September. And we found that rainfall decrease was significant, statistically significant, in the early part of the cool season, mainly April, May. And while there wasn't a significant decrease in the rest of the cool months, the trend was down, and there just wasn't that those high rainfall amounts falling before the decades of last century. So from about the 1990s, this trend and this change has occurred. We found that the runoff from the catchment had decreased by the flow down the river had decreased by 30% since the 1990s. Yes, it's a constant theme of decreasing available water in this area, inland southeast Australia, and combined with heating, and it's due to several factors. In some of those studies, we found through machine learning techniques that we could untangle the climate drivers that are most dominant.
How do you know, though, that this isn't part of a long drying cycle? I mean, just as a build-up, we had that in the U.S. Southwest many centuries ago, and then they had like an 800-year drought, just a dry spell. And I do recall a theory that Australia was perhaps fortunate that the settlers arrived during a wetter period and now going into a drier period. How do we know it is human-induced climate change rather than a long climate cycle?
Well, one of the major features of global warming is the contraction, and it all climate models, main climate models, national climate models know this from decades ago, is that there's a contraction poleward of the normal mid-latitude westerly winds. Now, in the southern hemisphere, they are not as wavy as they are in the northern hemisphere because of all the land mass and that creates different temperature and meridional contrasts. Climate models have consistently said that these mid-latitude zonal westerly winds will contract poleward because of the heating in the tropics, and eventually the sea will heat up and that will extend down towards the poles, and that will change the circulations, the atmospheric circulation. And that's what we've found has been happening, because one of the main climate drivers, which interacts with all the other climate drivers, the main climate driver is this index that determines the latitude, the north-south swing in the zonal westerly winds. That has decreased the number of cool season frontal systems that are affecting southern Australia. Also allows onshore winds onto the east coast because of the lack of frontal systems coming from the other direction, from west to east. Now we get consistent with this global warming climate change is this, we get strong, short, brief, record-producing rainfall amounts over in parts of inland Australia, which are unprecedented. They can produce, within a daily amount, can produce a yearly record, and that's been happening over the last few years. So it's all consistent with this proposition that global warming is causing these things to occur.
Well, right. Most of the media and people who live in the Northern Hemisphere are learning about the polar vortex, which can bulge down into North America or Europe with Arctic cold. And that's something that happens in the stratosphere, but it affects weather down here in the troposphere. But I would like to also use your paper as a bit of a springboard to get into learning about one of the most misunderstood factors in weather for Australia, and I would presume New Zealand and southern South America, and that's the Southern Annular Mode, or SAM for short. Few people know what that really is. What is it?
It's an index, and it measures the latitude of where the westerly winds are that go around the mid-latitudes. If it's in a positive mode, a positive index, that means the westerly winds are further poleward on average. And if it's negative, the westerly winds and the low pressure systems, if you like, that accompany the zonal winds are more equatorward. And that's when they affect continents like Australia, because Australia is basically all in the subtropics. There's one island, Tasmania, which is in the 40 to 45 degree latitude range. It takes a negative SAM index to get westerly winds and frontal systems in winter, in the cool season, to produce rainfall like we've had in the past, in earlier last century. And whereas now the trend for that SAM is to be positive. So instead of getting westerly winds in winter with associated frontal systems and rain bands, we're getting high pressure just south of the Australian continent. So we're just getting that reduced rainfall. This is slightly different effects around South America and Africa, but it's basically the same thing. The droughts are there in various regions, and they are getting the downpours as well from... In Australia, if we've got a southern annular mode that's in a positive phase in the warm season, from October to about March, we're getting these on the east, but certainly in the east, we're getting coastal downpours, as we're getting now in the last few days. We're getting constant thunderstorms, very heavy short bursts of rainfall and flash floods on the coastal areas and a little bit further inland as well.
So you used machine learning in your paper. What is the difference between machine learning, which is now widely used in scientific studies, and artificial intelligence? Is there a difference?
Well, machine learning is a sub-branch of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence just produces algorithms to imitate what human beings are doing, whereas machine learning creates mathematical models using machine learning techniques that comes up with results that allow scientists to make interpretations based on those dominant attributes that machine learning can devise. So you can reason more based on those results, whereas artificial intelligence is just creates an algorithm on past data without much interpretation at all.
But there is a move on to try and use the coupled model, the intercomparison project, that kind of great big model, and sort of make a hybrid with a neural network or some more artificial intelligence type move. What do you see there?
I mean, I've read that just this year there's a sort of hybrid statistical model using machine learning that combines the machine learning techniques with a general circulation model and in some sort of process. I mean, I don't know that much about it, but it's been reported in the literature as this is the future way to go with general circulation models, because the hardest thing with trying to predict extreme events is the it is the hardest thing to do with models. It's trying to predict the extreme events. So we need all these tools that can update past data. One of the particular techniques is, it's basically time series forecasting, but you need to update your data to the more relevant data, like a few years or previous, depending on what has been occurring more recently, as opposed to what's happened, say, 30 years ago. When you do this in a general circulation model, you also would need to do this over sort of regional areas. Every region will be different. So, for example, eastern Australia would be different to southern Australia, to seasons and months in terms of climate predictions.
Are you suggesting that with machine help, experts could produce localized climate forecasts similar to weather forecasts in a way?
Yes, that's what this neural network modeling combined with the climate model is capable of doing, where you can actually do a weather forecast, say, out to maybe a month, and then it changes. Then you could just change it to a climate forecast by, depending on what the attributes, the climate drivers, dominant climate drivers are.
We began talking with facts showing significant disasters have doubled in the last 20 years. What if these disasters double again in the next 20 years? That would be like 15,000 severe disasters every year, 40 a day on average. Do we know if this upward curve of more and more disasters is going to continue to increase if we keep putting more emissions into the atmosphere?
Well, the impact of putting more emissions into the atmosphere, the impact of this global warming will increase. I can't see it decrease. I can't see the impacts based on what we've been experiencing. I can't see that decreasing. It's just that some places will have, for example, flash floods and flash droughts that haven't had those before. Long-term droughts, of course, will continue as they have in California and in parts of Australia.
I think what really attracted me to your paper, as well as my interest in Australia, we do have listeners in Australia, is that it really seems to change what climate change itself means and how we talk about it, that we can't go with these generalized average models anymore. We have to look at specific instances in the real world that make big differences when they hit. Do you think that's a fair assessment of what your work is?
I think it is. I should mention that most climate models use averages, long-term averages, for things like, just taking one example, the amount of heat that's absorbed or reflected to outer space. Now, if you're in a long-term or flash drought, you'll have vegetation that's different, and models use values for vegetation. For example, it'll use factors for, and these are actual values, for forest, desert, grasslands. These tend, have tended to be long-term averages, whereas if you're having rapid flash droughts or flash floods, your vegetation is changing very much more quickly. I think another one would be the values of sea surface temperatures, although I think most climate models, I'm not quite sure on this, but a lot of them would have five-year averages for sea surface temperatures. Some of them may use longer averages. So the factors that go into the modelling need to be changed as well.
Yes, we talked to Kevin Trenberth, and he talked about the blob that was out in the Pacific. Now, you get marine heat waves that can kill off a billion fish or something. They may not last longer than a year or so, so they don't really, they may affect the average, but they don't show up in their true impact. From Sydney, Australia, we've been speaking with Milton Spear, visiting fellow at the University of Technology in Sydney. You can find links to his paper, Machine Learning Suggests Climate and Seasonal Definitions Should Change Under Global Warming. It's in my show blog, too, along with some helpful articles in the conversation that Milton has written. Thank you for spending time with our listeners.
It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
A paper released says that by 2047, the coldest years will be hotter than the warmest years of the last two decades. We've already set new temperature records, and those will be the cold years we look back on.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.
In the year 2525, Venice Beat, featuring Testimony.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if a woman can survive, they may
your eyes, you won't find a thing to choose.